The disagreements that emerged at this week's G20 summit in Seoul came as a disappointment to leaders who wanted to build on the cooperation evident at previous G20 meetings. At the height of the financial crisis about 2 years ago, governments agreed on a common course of action and pledged to avoid protectionism. They largely kept those promises, and the global economy began to turn around. But this summit has left leaders worrying that the recovery is now in jeopardy. NPR's Tom Jilton has more.
It was clear in the weeks leading up to Seoul that this G20 summit was unlikely to be as productive as the ones that preceded it. The sense of an imminent global crisis had passed. The United States and other industrial countries had turned their attention to their own economic difficulties, says Kamal Dervish of the Brookings Institution.
The recovery is weak, unemployment is persistent, and unless international cooperation can give some immediate results, there's not much political willingness to wait for international cooperation to help.
The big developing countries like China, Brazil, and India have fared much better since the financial crisis. Dervish, a former treasury minister in Turkey, says the improving conditions in these emerging economies explains their more inward focus.
They feel that they should just move on. They feel impatient, and they don't necessarily feel threatened the way they felt 18 months ago by the worldwide economic crisis. So for different reasons, they also are in a somewhat less cooperative mood.
And yet cooperation remains vital. Two big issues loomed over this G20 meeting. One was the need to address the great imbalance between the big exporting countries like China and the big importing countries like the United States. One way to do that was to get exchange rates more in line so that countries weren't undercutting each other in the market pricing of their products. Another goal was to promote freer trade. British Prime Minister David Cameron was worried enough on the eve of the summit to warn of the dangers of a new era of protectionism.
Countries would increasingly be tempted to try to maximize their own growth and their own employment at the expense of others. Globalization, the force that has been so powerful in driving development and bringing huge numbers into the world economy, could go into reverse. If we follow that path, we will all lose out.
The final G20 communique released yesterday reaffirmed the intention of countries to work for balanced trade and more currency stability. But the wording was general, without specific commitments. Richard Portas is president of the Center for Economic Policy Research in London.
We're not going to see any more currency stability coming out of this. We're not going to see more trade coming out of this. What positive results do we have? Nothing much is going to happen.
With no agreement at Seoul to avoid currency wars, governments may now feel more free to seek other advantages against their trading partners. The G20 leaders did not make evident progress on a new global trade pact, and the United States and South Korea failed to reach a trade agreement of their own. But there is a more positive view of the G20 summit. Kamal Dervish, who participated in these meetings back when he was Turkey's treasury minister, points out that the G20 process itself is important. Decisions about the global economy are now being made by a broader group of governments than was the case in the past, and that, Dervish says, gives these governments more of a stake in those decisions.
It's true that on trade, great progress hasn't been made, but again, I think cooperation of the G20 has helped not slide back. And I think that's sometimes as important and even more difficult than making progress.
It used to be that the United States and the other big industrial countries could manage world economic affairs on their own. With the growing importance of these G20 summits, that has changed. In fact, the biggest news out of Seoul was an agreement to give developing countries a bigger voice in the organization responsible for the world economy, the International Monetary Fund. Tom Jelton, NPR News, Washington.
Greetings, it is I, the Count, and you're just in time to count some apples with me. Here we go. One apple. Two apples. Three apples. Yes, three apples.
So it turns out that the Count from Sesame Street is actually onto something, at least according to a new study by the University of Chicago. A psychology professor there, Susan Levine, found that if you just repeat numbers to toddlers, you know, teaching them to count one, two, three, well, that's not enough. It's how you talk about numbers that makes a difference, and it could actually predict how well they do in math as older kids.
Parents tend to engage in various kinds of talk about number, ranging from let's recite the number words, you know,
let's count
for
with
me,
them, yeah,
to actually counting objects and talking about set size. And it turns out that that second form of counting objects and, you know, saying, oh, you have four cars, 1, 2, 3, 4, while you point at them, seems to be better.
So it's not just about the sequence. It's not just about, you know, making sure that kids can say 1, 2, 3, and 4, but actually showing them what that means.
Exactly, because just about all two-year-olds can rattle off the sequence from 1 to 10. But then if you ask them to give you three objects, they'll just grab a handful. So they can say them, but they don't understand what they mean. It's like eeny, meeny, miny, mo, or A, B, C, D, E, F, G.
So explain how you did your study.
What we did for the study is we went into people's homes, and we asked parents to just interact with their children as they normally would. And we videotaped those interactions. Then we went back to the lab and transcribed everything the parents said, as well as how they gestured, and everything the child said and how they gestured while they were talking.
And so what did you find?
Over that 7.5-hour period, kids heard as few as 4 number words from their parents. And at the high end, it was over 200. Hmm. And if you extrapolate that out, you know, over a week, some kids may be hearing as few as 20 number words and others as many as 1,800. So it's a huge difference in the opportunity to learn.
So you were looking at kids between the ages of 14 and 30 months.
Right, from about a year old to 2.5 years old.
Now, all those kids are in third and fourth grade now.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of correlation are you finding between their mathematical abilities at school and the way their parents talk to them about numbers?
We haven't yet related the early number talk to their math achievement at the third and fourth grade level. But, you know, when we look at how the early number talk predicts what the kids know about number at 4 years of age, there is a strong correlation in terms of kids' understanding on a task where we say to them, point to 4, and there might be on one side of the page 4 dots and on the other side 3 dots. Kids' understanding of what 4 means or 3 means or 5 means is really correlated to how much the parents talk to them about number, as well as whether they gave them the talk linked to objects rather than just talking about, you know, let's recite the number words.
That's University of Chicago psychology professor Susan Levine. Her study about how preschoolers learn numbers is in the journal Developmental Psychology. Professor Levine, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Manny Pacquiao doesn't so much punch his opponents as he pistol whips them with his fists. Manny Pacquiao is the boxer of the decade. He also happens to be an elected member of the Philippines House of Representatives and a platinum recording artist. But tonight, he's all boxer. He steps into the ring to fight super welterweight Antonio Margarito at Cowboy Stadium in Arlington, Texas. We spoke to him on Thursday, ahead of the fight. Mr. Pacquiao, thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, thank you. Thank you for giving me my time.
How did you start boxing?
I started boxing when I was 12 years old. Then I turned pro when I was 16.
And what interested you about it?
Because I want to help my parents to get money to buy food. That's why.
You know, you do so many things and have been so successful and are so wealthy. Why do you keep fighting?
I keep fighting because boxing is my passion, and I'm still can't fight, you know. But maybe I'm not going to stay longer in boxing because I have, and I'm getting old, and I have my political career, so.
Yeah. I think it's safe to say that you are the great hero of the Philippine nation. Is it sometimes hard to, in a sense, carry your homeland on your back when you get into the ring?
There's a pressure about that, but, you know, that's why on every fight I have to train hard because the hope of the Filipino nation is in my shoulder, so I have to win the fight.
Well, your trainer, Freddie Roach, has given some interviews where he says he sometimes worries that between you being a congressman and your concern for politics and your music, that it's sometimes hard to focus you on training for a fight.
The focus is always there. I'm always hungry to the fight. And what I believe, if you train hard and you jog in the morning and train in the afternoon, and you know, you do something. It's not a distraction.
I don't know. When you've been champion in 7 different weight classes, it's hard not to think that you won't be satisfied in politics until you're president of the Philippines. You want to be president of the Philippines?
I'm not thinking about that right now, but I'm focusing to being a congressman and what I can give to my constituents and, you know, what project I can give it to them.
I've heard that kind of answer before from politicians. May I ask, what are your most important political goals? What would you like to achieve in Congress?
I would like to, you know, achieve, you know, giving a livelihood and free education. Of course, my province, we don't have a provincial hospital, so I'm going to create a provincial hospital and give medical assistance. Also, I want to be a champion in terms of public service, not only in boxing, but also as a public servant.
You know, Mr. Pacquiao, we've done stories about brain damage in boxing. There are people who retire even when they're 29 and 30, and years later they have some problem. Do you ever worry about that?
Yes, I mean, I'm thinking about that because I'm a boxer, so I have to consider that problem. And, you know, that's why right now I'm thinking that I'm not going to stay long in boxing because I'm getting older and, you know, I have to plan my future properly.
Mr. Pacquiao?
Yes.
Knowing what we know now about concussions, would you tell other 12-year-old boys to go into boxing nowadays?
No, I don't want to encourage them to go in boxing. I want them to finish their school and follow my step in as a politician.
You want them to be around to vote for you? Well, Mr. Pacquiao, it's been an honor to talk to you, sir. Take care.
Right. Thank you, Scott.
Manny Pacquiao, singer, congressman, and boxer. Tonight he fights for the Super Welterweight Championship of the World in Arlington, Texas.
It's going to be a great fight.
Listening to NPR News.
Who has time to read fiction these days? I mean, between carpools, soccer games, being on hold with your credit card company or internet provider, blah, blah, etc., etc. But Robert Swartwood has compiled a collection of fiction in which the stories are short enough to be text messages. Hint Fiction, an anthology of stories in 25 words or fewer. Robert Swartwood joins us from New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And I gather you were inspired by a 6-word Ernest Hemingway story.
The Ernest Hemingway story, yes. For sale, baby shoes never worn.
My gosh, if you just added a beat or two, it could be haiku, couldn't it?
Yes.
So what makes Hint Fiction Hint Fiction? Not just the length, I assume.
No, I think that, a lot of fiction, no matter, you know, what the length, a lot of fiction does hint at always a larger story, but with the brevity of, especially the Hemingway story and, you know, the stories in this collection, because they're so short, they just rely on the reader's imagination, on hinting at a larger story.
Let's get you to read some, share some with us, if you could.
Sure.
For example, a story called House Hunting by Gary Bronbeck.
The fence is tall. Good. The mother is typical white trash, too loud. But the kids, they seem frightened and quiet. Good. Easier that way.
Ooh, my blood runs cold.
Yeah, it's very, very effective.
And let me read this one, if I could, Joe Schreiber. It's called Progress. After 17 days, she finally broke down and called him Daddy. Oh, my gosh. How'd you compile these stories?
I had a contest at my website, and it became a really big contest because word just kind of circulated around the internet. And then later on, after the Norton had contacted us about doing an anthology, we opened it up to general submissions and received over 2,000.
Do you find you believe in the form now that you've been through so many?
You know, with the over 2,000 submissions, a lot of them, they came across more like first sentences or just random thoughts. Or they were like, you know, last sentences. And the initial thought is that it's easy because, yeah, you should be able to sit down and write a sentence or two in a couple seconds. That shouldn't be hard. But actually, you know, writing a couple seconds that are meaningful and that say the right words, that's very hard. Actually, one of the contributors in here, Edith Perlman, she has a story called Golden Years. And she had sent an email. It took her like a couple hours to come up with her story.
Could you read that one to us?
Sure. She, macular. He, Parkinson's. She, pushing. He, directing. They get down the ramp, across the grass, through the gate. The wheels roll riverwards.
That does make your mind reel, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Let's read a few more. K.J. Moss, Silence. She wondered what it was like in his silent world and wished she could tell him. Instead, she traced his eyebrow with her fingertips. That is a whole story, condensed, isn't it?
It's a whole story, yeah. I mean, a lot of these stories, they could be expanded into, you know, longer stories, but as they are, they're complete, which is, like, again, the challenge and, I guess, the kind of the beauty of the form.
What about Sarah Lyons, the date?
How could he admit that this was not actually the first time he had seen Claudia's scar? He couldn't. He would have to feign surprise.
And you can foresee, if you please, how that would lead to another story. But on the other hand, there's also something satisfying.
Yeah.
If it ends right there, you understand it, too.
Yeah.
Now, as enjoyable as this is, do you have any fear that this could just continue to encourage the short attention spans we keep hearing about? Make your answer quick, by the way, 25 words or less. I'm kidding.
I was almost tempted to try. There is the mindset that the anthology and these hint fiction pieces are just another part of people's ADD, that this is just going to kind of help make it worse. But I actually see that oftentimes, and I've gotten emails from readers who kind of like, you know, they were inspired by these really small stories to kind of write their own short stories. And so, they started small and they kind of worked their way up, which was really great to hear. I think that also by doing hint fiction, it also kind of helps writers grow as writers and helps them learn word choice and kind of helps them with their longer forms.
You're kind enough to send us some of your favorites, so let's finish up, if we can, with a lightning round of that, okay?
Sure.
Let's begin with Joe Lansdale's wonderful The Return.
They buried him deep again. he undercuts the Hemingway story by one word. Actually, well, see, and that's another thing, too, about hint fiction. Because the stories are so short, the title is really part of the story.
Let me read Eric Sue's story, An Impromptu Robbery. Think about this, Francis Ford Coppola fans. The pen, which was attached to the bank counter, did not go all the way through his throat. Oh, my word. And could you take Houston, We Have a Problem?
Yes. This is J. Matthew Zoss's Houston, We Have a Problem. I'm sorry, but there's not enough air in here for everyone. I'll tell them you were a hero.
Oh, boy. Well, let me follow that with Nick Arvin's knock-knock joke. My father, standing in the sink with white sleeves rolled, says, knock, knock. I say, who's there? She loves who? He says, exactly.
Hmm.
Mm. Well, I enjoyed these stories, I must say, Mr. Swartwood. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Robert Swartwood, editor of Hint Fiction, an anthology of stories in 25 words or fewer. You can read more very short stories and submit your own hint fiction at our website, npr.org. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. A number of Republicans who got elected to Congress earlier this month promised to try and repeal and replace the new federal health care law. In Washington, that's a pretty tall order, at least as long as President Obama remains in the White House. But much of the new law needs the cooperation of the states. And the Republicans picked up a net of about half a dozen governorships and 19 state legislative chambers. NPR's Julie Rovner joined us to talk about what impact state officials may have on the prospects for implementing the new health care law. Julie, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
So it's a federal law. What role do the states have at all?
Well, quite a lot. For all the rhetoric about this being a federal takeover of the healthcare system, states actually have an enormous role to play in implementing the law. Everything from creating and operating these new marketplaces called insurance exchanges where people will buy insurance, to enrolling low-income people in Medicaid, to policing insurance premium rates, how fast they go up. Now, if the states choose not to do any of those things, the federal government will do them instead. But the anticipation going in with this law is that states would step up and work in partnership with the federal government.
And what are we hearing from states, especially those that that have elected new Republicans in the state assembly or governorships?
Well, we're hearing a lot of different things. In some cases, it's mostly political rhetoric, ranging from some are saying they don't want any part of it. That's what about-to-be former Governor Tim Pawlenty of Minnesota had said, and it looks like he's going to be replaced by a Democrat who would take a very different attitude. But next door in Wisconsin, a Democrat who was very active in getting his state to act early to implement the law, Jim Doyle, is being replaced by a Republican, Scott Walker, who says he wants to minimize his state's participation. Then you've got several new Republican governors who want to join in legal efforts to overturn the law on constitutional grounds, although it may be too late for them to join lawsuits. States have mostly been found ineligible to challenge the part of the law that requires most individuals to have insurance, but they are still challenging the part requiring them to expand Medicaid coverage so that people up to 133% of poverty have coverage under Medicaid.
And speaking of Medicaid, some Republican legislators in Texas have suggested that the state might pull out of Medicaid. Can they do that?
It's an interesting question, and nobody really knows the answer. You know, Medicaid, which is this health program for the poor, the federal government pays just over half of Medicaid costs in every state, and in the poorer states, it actually pays the vast majority of costs, as much as 80%. But states say the money comes with so many strings attached that they can't afford their share, even the states that only pay 20% of every dollar. On the other hand, giving up Medicaid would mean states would have to figure out how to cover elderly people in nursing homes, disabled people in and out of institutions, and lots of people with very, very high medical bills. And, you know, the lawsuits that I was just talking about, the crux of one of them is that requirement to expand Medicaid to people a little higher up the income scale is actually that requirement is coercive to the states because states can't afford to drop Medicaid. So obviously, if states were to go ahead and do it, it would prove that that lawsuit has no merit because states could then do it.
So what happens then, Julie, if, say, half the states implement the law aggressively and half choose not to?
You know, I think that was always going to be the case. Yes, there are now several more states that have Republican governors and may come at this law with a little bit of a more jaundiced eye. But even before that, we had a relatively even split. And I think states were always going to look at this differently depending on their populations, on their political cultures, on what they already had going on in their states. So I think states are going to learn from some states' successes and others' failures. Again, states that don't do anything, there is a federal backup. The federal government will come in if states don't do anything. But I think as with everything else with this law, it's a matter of watching and waiting.
NPR health policy correspondent Julie Robner, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And you're listening to NPR News.